has a couple different meanings. As an adjective, it just means like something extremely annoying or very difficult. But in a legal sense, it also can mean to examine and determine judicially the guilt or innocence of a person. And then it also carries the meaning of to severely test, to like put to test or to put under a strain, like as of endurance or patience or affliction or trouble. And you can see that Jesus experienced all these aspects of trying, right? He was tested. He was put under literally trial, and he was under a lot of strain during this period of time and that night. Oftentimes, we will experience circumstances in life that are very trying for us, that will test us. And maybe you are right now, at this moment in your life. They seem to be random and senseless at times. Like, we don't understand why this is happening to me and why now. For example, my professor, my mentor, advisor, when I was at Gordon-Conwell, Dr. Gary Parrott, and there he is with his wife and his daughter. I remember in 2009, early 2009, I was in his office, and I was studying for a degree called the Doctor Ministry, and I was coming to the end where I had kind of delayed and delayed and delayed, and it was like if I didn't finish that year, then it was like, you know, I'd be out. So all my work and everything would be gone and useless. So I was in his office in that January, and I remember talking to him and telling him, like, should I continue? Do you think it's worth it? Or I got a lot of work to do yet. And then I remember at one point he just smiled and he said, Jeff, hold on a second. And he gets up and he's like looking at his bookshelf and he's like, wait, it's here somewhere. It's here somewhere. Maybe he's up here. Where is that? And he's like, oh, here it is. He pulls it out and he goes, this is my dissertation. And he says, you know what? See how dusty it is? He says, I think after I wrote it, I never referred to it again. He says, and I don't know if anybody else has ever read it either. He says, it's just, you know, don't be so worried about doing it perfect. He says, just do the best you can, finish it, and we'll work with you on, you know, how to improve it and stuff. He says, I think you can do it. So he's a big encouragement that way. I just remember that. But last year, on July 3rd, he was in South Korea, and he was on his way back to the airport, I think to return home, and his bus that he was on, it was on a bridge, it swerved to avoid an oncoming truck, which had swerved to avoid a broken-down car, and the bus lost control and broke through the guardrail and went off the bridge. And this is one of those big buses. There was like 24 people. And it fell 30 feet and landed on its roof. And 12 people died. And Dr. Parrott himself was severely injured. Brain injury, hemorrhaging, punctured lung, broken, I think, neck and things like that. He was in bad shape. His good friend, Pastor Kenny Yeh from, I think it's a High Rock Covenant Church in Arlington, Massachusetts, was with him, and he was killed. He had just been installed as the associate pastor of that church recently before that. He was a good friend of the Parrott family, too. And this progress, Dr. Parrott survived, but he was in a coma for like over a month, and his family then had to, you know, fly to Korea, and he was in Korea for that month in a coma. They were trying to revive him or help him wake up, and slowly he started to come out of that. It wasn't like he just woke up. It was like this semi-consciousness, and he slowly came out of that coma. It took him forever to even be able to like form words again and be able to speak. Something to do with the brain injury, recovery, and now he is able to speak and talk, and he can even write and things like that, but he's still going to intensive therapy, and who knows when he's going to be able to return to teaching as a professor like he did before. And, his family, his wife and his daughter, they've seen God's grace and his mercies through this whole process of the accident in Korea, then transporting him back to Boston area, and all the therapy and the doctors working with him. But why? Why would something this crazy happen? And then the church that he went to, this High Rock Church, they lost a pastor too, and he's severely injured. Why do these senseless things happen? But his family, Dr. Gary Parrott's family, put their trust in God the whole time, and they saw his grace and his mercy, even despite the difficult circumstances. You know, our text in Mark chapter 14, verses 43 through 65, it picks up, and things are just about to go from fairly peaceful to bad, and then to worse, we see, for Jesus and his disciples. Well, it picks up Jesus right after Jesus had said in the previous verse, if you go jump back and you can see, Jesus had said to Peter, James, and John, who he was praying or was with him while he was praying, "Let us go. Here comes my betrayer." And that's where we ended last week. And Jesus, and this, just take note that Jesus, nothing took him by surprise during this evening. He knew what was going to happen to him. And matter of fact, he had told his disciples many times before that. He anticipated the troubles that were going to happen to him that night. Have you ever had a day or a week where things just seemed to go bad? And then they went from bad to worse? And it seemed like everything was focused on like working against you? Did you ever have that experience? Things just didn't work out, and you try to fix it, and then that wouldn't work out. And I call it like this situational vortex. It happens a lot on my house projects, you know. You go to do something, then you can't find the tool you need, so then you go looking for the tool you need to do the thing you wanted to do. But then when you're looking for the tool you need, you find out something else you needed to do that you forgot, so you start to do that. But then to do that, you don't have something that you need to do that, so you have to go to Home Depot. So then you go to Home Depot, and you know, and it just keeps going on and on. Pretty soon you're so far away from what you originally planned to do, you just totally forgot about it. And it's just a situational vortex. Everything doesn't work your way. And if you're like me, sometimes I get really, really frustrated by that. And that's very minimal level. If you look at what happened to Christ or Dr. Parrott, that's severe scale of bad things happening. Do we get to the point where we get angry and we feel like, why is this happening to me? And why now? And why is this all directed toward me? It seems like I'm the target of all these bad things happening. And we get angry about that. Well, Jesus knew he was the target and the reason why these circumstances were happening in his life. And he knew it ahead of time. He anticipated it. Yet he was calm and he was steady when he was arrested and tried by the high priest. Right? We didn't see him freak out when the Jewish religious leaders were questioning him or falsely accusing him. He didn't go crazy or defend himself. Jesus told his disciple multiple times before this happened that it would happen. Look at some of the texts that we've looked at before in Mark, earlier in Mark, chapter 8, verse 31. It says there, "He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again." And then again, later in Mark, chapter 10, verses 32 through 34, listen to what it says there. "They were on their way up to Jerusalem when Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them that was what was going to happen to him. 'We are going up to Jerusalem,' he said, 'and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise.'" Jesus anticipated his troubles, and he even anticipated and knew the specifics of what would happen to him. The things that he mentioned there, the specifics where we find in our own text, where they're starting to beat him and spit on him. He had, if you just look at what happened to Jesus, just a few hours, in a course of a few hours, how would you handle this course of turn of events? Okay, look, just think about it. He started off with an intimate meal with his closest disciples, the 12 disciples. And then only later to have one of those close 12 disciples named Judas betray him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And when Judas showed up at Gethsemane, the crowd with Judas, which was armed with swords and clubs, they probably didn't know what Jesus looked like. And plus it was dark, it was at night, so they needed him to let them know who to arrest. And so Judas had this like signal. And we see Judas's plan in Mark chapter 14, verse 44. Judas tells his plan. He says there, "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Now, this was a customary way of greeting a teacher or someone you respected. But it's ironic here that this warm gesture would be used as a sign of betrayal. So Judas goes and he kisses Jesus. Mark chapter 14, verses 45 through 47 continues saying, "Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, 'Rabbi,' and kissed him. And the men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. The armed men seized Jesus once Judas kissed him and arrested him. And at first, one of the disciples draws the sword. And we know that disciple to be Peter from the account written in John. So Peter draws his sword and cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. And we know that from Luke's account that Jesus healed this ear. I imagine if you've ever seen the Passion of Christ, it doesn't show it graphically, but it shows like Jesus looking at the guy, and then he looks down on the ground, and he like picks up the ear, and then he like puts it on back on the guy's head, and then he lets it go, and the guy's like, "Wow, this is cool," you know. Yeah, and they do kind of a good scene there, showing that healing. But so from John and Luke, we get a little more details about that issue, and it's interesting that Mark is recording this in a sense, a record of Peter's teachings, but he chooses not to use the name Peter. He just says someone drew a sword and cut off the guy's ear. And then from Luke's account, also we see he tells Peter to stop fighting and calms the other disciples down, Jesus does. And then in Mark, Jesus says to those arresting him in verses 48 and 49, Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." You know, it continues to amaze me that Jesus is calm and collected here when he is being arrested, especially when he was just agonizing in prayer in the garden. Right before Judas came and right before he was arrested, remember last week he was agonizing in prayer and he was asking the Lord God to spare him, to remove this cup from him, if possible. But not his will, but the Lord's will be done. So he submits to God's will. But he just is not looking forward to this, and he's agonizing in prayer over this. And in Luke's account, it says he's agonizing so much he was like sweating like drops of blood, an emotional turmoil. And then he's now calm and steady. But his agony wasn't necessarily over the fact of what he would face physically, though I would think if I were him, I wouldn't be looking forward to that either. But he was agonizing because of the idea that he would be separated from his Father, God the Father, when he bore the sins of the whole world when he was nailed to that cross, because he was paying the penalty for your sins and my sins and all of mankind's sins. And then when he became sin on that cross, God the Father would have to turn away and break fellowship with his Son, which had never been done before. And that's what Christ was in agony, that he wanted that, to be spared of that, if possible. But then Judas comes, and he faces this with great calm and question and strength. And we don't see him lose control. All of Jesus' disciples then took off and ran away. And Jesus anticipated this too. We saw last week on their way to Gethsemane, he told them that you're all going to fall away. But in Mark, we see in verse 50, it just simply says, "Then everyone deserted him and fled." Now, it's interesting here in verses 51 and 52, these two verses are only found in the account of Mark. And there's been speculation of why. Why are they here and not in any of the three other Gospels? It says there in 51 and 52, "A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind." Now, we're not sure if that meant like naked or if he had a little loincloth on, but it doesn't make a difference, right? He's just running around with hardly anything on or nothing. But many Bible scholars believe that this two verses is indicating that it's Mark, the writer of this account. It's like his could be his signature. Like if you're a painter and you do a painting, right, on your canvas, and then at the end you sign or you make your mark somewhere on the corner or somewhere hidden in the canvas or in the painting. This is like Mark's signature, because the feeling is that the Lord's Supper that up in the upper room was probably in his parents' house. That's the thought. And then so he either followed Jesus and the disciples after they left to come to the garden of Gethsemane, or this thought that maybe Judas, when he took the crowd, they first went to that house because that's where Judas knew them to be, right? Because he left there to go betray Jesus. So the first place they would have gone is to Mark's house. And they would have realized he's not there. So then Judas would think, oh, they probably went to the Gethsemane, which we often go to. And they would have gone there. So Mark could have followed the crowd, the armed crowd there. And so Mark, that would mean that Mark was a witness to Jesus' arrest as well as a very young man. So everybody scattered, including Mark. But we find that Peter did not run that far away, right? Because in verse 54 it says, Peter followed them after they arrested Jesus and bound him at a distance. And from the Gospel of John, we know that John, the disciple John, was also with Peter, following from a distance. And they followed him all the way into the courtyard of the high priest. And so this trial takes place, or what we call trial takes place in the house of the high priest. And just the fact that it was in the house of the high priest made this trial illegal, because trials were only supposed to be held in the temple complex, not in somebody's house. And then it was also held at night, very late. So probably the full complement of the Sanhedrin, all 71 people, were probably not there. There were probably some missing members, maybe Joseph of Arimathea, which is mentioned later, who took Jesus' body down and buried it in his tomb, or Nicodemus, maybe, who seemed to have some support and favor for Jesus. You know, we can only assume that they probably weren't there, or maybe some others, because it was kind of an ad hoc thing, sudden, spontaneous gathering of this group of religious leaders. Then they go into the trial, and no witnesses could be found to agree, right? We see this in the text. And the only accusation that's actually spelled out here is one thing that Jesus claimed in verse 61, when he said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, the Gospel of John explains that Jesus actually just meant his body, not the actual physical temple in Jerusalem, and that he was going to be raised up in 3 days after he was crucified. But even in this account, they could not find any corroborating evidence, because people were saying different things. You see, they were being very careful to try to find evidence so that they could put Jesus to death. They wanted to get rid of Jesus, and that was the whole purpose of this trial. And like in every trial, evidence is very important. Very important. When there's a trial, both sides, right, produce evidence to try to support their position as the truth. And then, ideally, there's a fair judgment based on the evidence at hand. And so that is what the role of the high priest was to be, is the one who makes the judge based on the evidence at hand. For example, did you hear of the Chinese woman who was just recently arrested and charged with murder, of the murder of her husband? It was just last month in Monroe Township. It was about 30 minutes south of here, if you go driving. Actually, Eliza, you work at the same place as this? Same building as this lady, yeah. Yeah. Her name is Tian Li, or Heidi in English, and she was arraigned for murder charges on March 9th, last month, and she's accused of murdering her estranged husband because they were in the process of getting a divorce by poisoning him with thallium. And the prosecuting attorney says that he has evidence to prove her guilt. And this is the evidence that he has. He says that this lady, Lee, obtained thallium from the supply room where she works at Bristol Myers Squibb. You must know that supply room then if you're in the same building. No, you don't? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. that's where she got the stallion, was from that supply room. Even though her research that she's doing has no need of thallium. So they must have a record or something that she took thallium. And then he claims that there's evidence that when she returned the 4 bottles of thallium she took, 90% of it was gone. So she used thallium, right, somehow. And hopefully her research supports how she used it, right? If not, she's going to have some explaining to do. And there also seems to be evidence that Lee applied for a rush visa for her son, who was born here in the States, so he's a United States citizen, to go back to China. She was applying for a visa for that. And then that 2 days before her husband died, which was January 24th, she tried to purchase airplane tickets to China, I assume. So on January 28th, her husband died on the 26th, just 48 hours after her husband's death, the authorities charged Lee with hindering her own apprehension and jailed her. And then 2 weeks later, she was charged with the murder of her husband by poisoning. Now, since she's pleaded non-guilty and gotten a lawyer, the lawyer that you saw in the picture, the guy sitting next to her was her lawyer. And you can see now, because this is a case is being built against her, evidence is so important. Not only evidence for the prosecuting attorney, but now her defense attorney is going to have to produce evidence to counter this. You know, it reminds me of Law and Order. How many of you have seen Law and Order, right? I love Law and Order because it's the defense and the prosecuting attorney, the DA, right? And they're always making those cases. It's very fascinating. But it's not so fascinating when you're the one being accused. The United States is a country founded on written law, right? What is the basic foundation of all the laws that we build and write? What is it? The Constitution of the United States, right? The founding fathers wrote that, and that is like the Supreme Court's framework for the challenge. You know, is it unconstitutional or is it constitutional? That's their job. That's what they do. So that is the basis of our society. Now, how many laws does the United States have? How many laws do you think we have? Where's Dean? Dean, do you know how many laws do we have? Dean's our resident lawyer. No, I thought that was lawyers, not the laws, right? No, I'm just kidding. Oh. He's used to those kind of jokes, right? Yeah. But, oh, yeah, he's learning, so maybe he remembers. You know how many laws? No? There's a lot. Well, for example, let me give you just the tax code. Okay, the federal tax code covers 17,000 pages and requires over 700 different forms possible for you to fill out. So the IRS estimates Americans spend 5.1 billion hours a year preparing their taxes. 5.1 billion hours. And the Tax Foundation estimates that those wasted hours cost the U.S. economy $194 billion a year just to prepare our taxes because it's so complex. You know, I use TurboTax just to answer the questions. Yeah. Now, the federal criminal code spans some 1,400 pages, and that's just the pocket edition of the federal criminal code. Now, we're not even talking about state law. We're just talking about federal law. Okay, and then the Federal Registry, which records all the regulations that the federal government imposes on businesses. Listen to this. And that means all of these regulations carry the force of law, like their laws. This exceeds 75,000 pages. Now you see the need for people like Dean, right? We need people just need to focus, and they don't even focus on all that. They pick their little area that they're going to focus on and be specific and know and be an expert on that, those laws. Law is very important to us as a society. And likewise, law was very important to the Jewish leaders of that day, especially the law of God. They knew it inside out. And they built their society on the written law and a lot of other laws that they added to it themselves. But the high priest broke the rules when he asked Jesus under oath if he was the Messiah, the Son of God. And he did that because he, in this role as high priest, was supposed to be the judge, the impartial judge. And he wasn't supposed to act in the sense of a prosecuting attorney, right, by asking questions. No, he was supposed to be the impartial judge. But here he is challenging, he says, under oath, you know, are you the Messiah, the Son of God? And he broke the rules when he did that. Jesus effectively then condemned himself by answering the way he did. In verse 62, he said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. For Caiaphas, this high priest, whose name is Caiaphas, who we find in other accounts, and the others, this alone, this statement here, that Jesus admitted his identity and then claimed that he will be coming in the clouds of heaven and sitting at the right hand, you know, this was cause for death. That alone was reason to kill Jesus. And so they blindfolded and spit on him, struck him, and sent him off with the guards, and they beat him. And Jesus knew this. But Jesus was just admitting the truth about who he was. And they would not accept that. Yet Jesus faced this trial with trust in God the Father and calm strength because he knew who he was. And he anticipated the end of all these events. And that was the forgiveness of sins and the eternal salvation of all those who would believe in him. And that is reason why he was willing to go through these trying circumstances that he was facing. Now, when our circumstances go from bad to worse, how do you often respond? When things just go, they really, really go bad, how do you respond? Do you get frustrated? Do you get depressed? Do you get angry? Do you get like more motivated to work harder? How do you respond? Jesus taught that his followers should also anticipate the trials and troubles that come our way because we will face them. And if you haven't yet in life, though I doubt there's nobody here that, I haven't faced anything in my life. No, we've all faced troubles and they're on different scales. Sometimes it's just a minor annoyance, but other times it's major tragedy or trouble in our life. Listen to what Jesus said in John chapter 15, verse 20. He taught there, remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. He's warning his disciples. And then in John 16, verse 33, he said, in this world you will have trouble. You will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Again, he's saying, you know, you're going to have trouble. So don't buy into that thought that if we follow Christ, he's going to make everything okay. We're going to be rich because he's going to bless us. We're going to be healthy because he's going to keep us away from sickness. And he's going to keep our life smooth and okay. You may have heard that message before, but you've got to deal with these verses here. Jesus says, you will have trouble. He's not saying, like, if you follow me and have enough faith, then you will not have trouble. No, he's saying you will have trouble. So anticipate this, but have faith because he has overcome the world. Now, this trouble can come in all kinds of ways, but are we ready for it? Do we anticipate it? When you wake up in the morning, is the thought in your mind, what kind of trouble am I going to face today? Is that what you think? I don't think that way. Usually I wake up and I'm like, oh, I don't know, what do I think? What am I going to have for breakfast? That's what I first thing I think. Yeah. But are we anticipating that we are going to face trouble? And how are we going to respond? Jesus warned us that we will. So will we walk through those times knowing and trusting in Jesus to help us through, to give us the strength, to provide us the guidance on how to act and what to decide when we face those difficulties, those tragedies, or those minor annoyances in life? Are we looking at it that way? Or will we lose sight of Christ and focus on ourselves and complain and try to get out of the situation somehow, avoid it or whatever, not deal with it? I mean, oftentimes you can ask me, I'm a whiner. If I get sick, usually that's when I start complaining. I complain that why did it happen to happen this week because I got a lot of work to do, you know. Or I start complaining that, you know, because of it, I can't breathe through my nose, you know, or my nose can't stop running. It's like a faucet I can't shut off, you know. And it's just so annoying, and I just complain rather than look to Christ for the strength to go through it. Why do we get angry at God when some things happen that we can't understand? Let me tell you the story of Bethany Hamilton. At the age of only 13, very young, on October 31st in 2003, she was surfing, and this 14-foot tiger shark came and bit off part of her surfboard and her left arm. Just took her arm right off. That's the surfboard she was on when her arm, when she still had her arm. And after losing over 60% of her blood and making it through several surgeries without infection, Bethany was on her way to recovery with an unbelievably positive attitude. She's like Miss Positive. And the lifeguards and the doctors believe that it was because of her faith and because of her water sense that she was able to get through this traumatic ordeal so well. And so miraculously, just 1 month after she lost her left arm, she was back in the water and trying to learn how to surf without one arm. And so she just put her heart to it because she loved to surf, and she was pursuing becoming a professional surfer at the age of 13. And in January 2004, this happened October 31st, that's only, what, a couple months, maybe, plus. Bethany made her return to surf competition, placing fifth in the open women's division of that contest. And then with no intention of stopping, Bethany continued to enter other competitions and excel in competition. And just over a year after the attack, she took first place in the Explorer Women's Division of the 2005 NSSA National Championships, winning her first national title, a woman with one arm. And in October 2004, now that's backtracking, that would mean she was only at the age of 14. She shared her life story in her own autobiography that she had helped writing, if you looked, there's two other names on it, but she called it Soul Surfer. And that book now has been made into a movie that will be actually released this Friday. And, yeah, I didn't know about this either until I was preparing for the message, and I came across this. And I've looked into it. It looks like a very interesting movie, and it's they've woven into this movie about how significant her own faith played a part in the fact that she was able to bounce back, in a sense, or get back into the water or back onto the surfboard like that. And it looks like it could be a very moving story, and it's got some very talented actors and actresses in there. So if something like this happened to us, how would we respond? How would you respond if you all of a sudden lost an arm? How would you respond? Would you be able to handle that in your life to move on? How would you view that? And why? Why would God allow something like that to happen to me, of all people? And why now? If we get really sick, and when we need to do like a lot of work this week, like a project at work or at school, and then you get really, really sick and you can't concentrate, how do you respond? Or if a friend betrays us, or we're laid off, or if somebody dies tragically, how do we respond to that? You see, trying circumstances, they will come. How will we look to Christ when they do as our guide through it? One of my favorite verses is Hebrews 12:2. Says there, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Christ was able to not only anticipate what was going to happen, but go through it because of the joy that was set before him. He knew what was on the other side of the circumstances that he was facing, the troubles, the difficulties. And that was eternal salvation for the people that he loved, mankind. He wanted to offer that. So for that joy set before him, he endured the cross. He endured that suffering for our behalf so that those of us who believe in him can then benefit from that eternal life, which starts right now and goes on for eternity. So there is joy, brothers and sisters, set before us. But can we fix our eyes on that? Because no matter what we face or what we're facing, we can go through it and endure it with Christ in our heart. Because we can see the joy that is set before us on the other side, the joy of eternal life with him, free from sin, free from suffering and all mourning and evil. So we can trust God is working in and through whatever we're experiencing for his good.